Well, good evening, one and all, people nearby and people in the Zoom. Good to see you. Let me just have a quick drink here, clear my throat. Well, I think as about half the people, maybe a little over half the people know, we have just started our practice period. This is a time when we intensify our practice to some extent. Each person is a little bit different. They have their own kind of intentions for this period. And it's also a time when we take up a particular topic of study. And for this practice period, we're looking at the Vimalakirti Sutra. So I won't say too much about that, but I will give a little bit of introduction for people who are new. So over this last weekend, Kate and I introduced this sutra or Buddhist text, the Vimalakirti Sutra. And if you were unable to come on the weekend or would like to hear the talks again, they are posted to the website. And I really recommend that you listen to them, particularly if you're interested at all in reading the sutra itself, because it's really good to have an introduction for that rather than kind of diving into this old Buddhist text kind of cold. However, for tonight, let me at least set the stage for those who were not here on the weekend. And I'll just say a few words about the sutra. So it's one of the earliest Mahayana texts in Buddhism. Mahayana being the stream of Buddhism that arose around the year 100 BCE to 100 AD particularly, and became particularly strong in China, Korea, Tibet, Japan, kind of East Asia and Tibet. Anyway, the main teaching of this text is the teaching of the non-dual nature of all things, or that everything is boundless. In other words, what we habitually separate into this and that, mine and hers, is not really the true understanding, the fundamental understanding of things. Rather, that everything arises out of a kind of infinite intimacy. And that is the ground of everything. And from that ground of intimate intimacy that is there, that everything is interconnected in a constant flow and dance, arises compassion. Because there is no difference, no ultimate, complete separation between you and the person sitting beside you. And the Mahayana understanding is that this is what really underlies this universe. Unlike many of the even earlier Buddhist writings, save the ones that were taught and then continued on shortly after the death of the Buddha. This particular text, the Vimalakirti text, uses humor, which is unusual in a religious text to have humor. Pretty interesting stories, I think. Magic and miracles and a great dramatic setting. All of that to help us really understand the teachings that are being given in this text. In fact, I think the whole text itself, the whole sutra, is a beautiful example of upaya, a Sanskrit word meaning skillful means, a way of teaching the Dharma that will touch everyone's understanding, deepen everyone's understanding. And the other thing that's interesting about this particular text is that the main protagonist, the main speaker, is not the Buddha. And usually the Buddha is the one who takes center stage. Rather, it's a layperson, like you and me, just a, well, I can't say he's just like Joe Average, he's actually a pretty super guy. But his name is Vimalakirti, his name is, of course, the title of the whole sutra. And he is a master of skillful means, a master that uses his profound insight and his abilities to relate the teachings, the kind of complex, sophisticated, and sometimes very challenging teachings of the Dharma. So this sutra begins with a grand spectacle of countless beings, both human and non-human, gathered around the Buddha to hear the Dharma, hear the teachings of the Buddha. And the Buddha starts off by performing a miracle of transforming 150 parasols that were given as offerings into one huge parasol that shelters everyone from the hot sun of India. And then he begins to offer the teachings that include the practices of a bodhisattva and, as I mentioned earlier, the unity of the universe, this fundamental unity. And there is one funny story that occurs in this opening chapter about one of the main male monks, Shariputra. But I think you'll appreciate it more if you listen to the talks that Kate and I gave on the weekend, or you read the opening chapter yourself rather than me trying to describe it really quickly here. So, to continue on now, a little bit of background there. The next chapter then introduces the main character, the main protagonist, this Vimalakirti. He's a businessman, he's a father, of course husband, a highly respected member of the city where he lives. But he's also a person who works tirelessly to teach the Dharma. And he is, of course, a very ardent practitioner and teacher who uses skillful means, all the techniques that he has, to help everyone understand and practice the Dharma, regardless of sex or status or person's place in society. In fact, Vimalakirti becomes ill, and he even uses his illness to instruct others. And he does this by pointing out the limitations of the human body to all of the people who come and visit him. And he encourages them and said, well, look, don't pay so much attention to the body, you know, going for plastic surgery and getting hair removal and, you know, getting your teeth whitened and all that stuff. He says, don't spend too much attention to that. Rather, he says, develop the Buddha body. And this is how he describes the Buddha body. He says, the Buddha body is the Dharma body. It is born from immeasurable merits and wisdom. It is born from perceptions, meditation, wisdom, emancipation, and the insight of emancipation, meaning a liberation or awakening. It is born from compassion, joy, and equanimity. It is born from the various paramitas, or what's paramita?
Perfections.
Such as generosity, keeping the precepts, forbearance or patience, gentleness, energy in spiritual practices, meditation, samadhi, wide knowledge and wisdom. That was what the Buddha body is born from. It is born from expedient means, or this upaya I talked about. It is born of the cutting off of all things not good and the gathering of all good things. It is born of truth, born of avoidance of indulgence and laxity. Good people, he tells everyone, if you wish to gain the Buddha body and do away with the ills that afflict all the living beings, you must set your minds on attaining perfect wisdom. In other words, awakening. Let that be the core of your being. So the text kind of wraps it up by saying, in this manner, the rich man Vimalakirti, oh, I didn't mention he was also wealthy, used the occasion to teach the Dharma to those who came to inquire about his illness. And as a result, this is repeated countless times in the sutra, numerous thousands of people were all moved to set their minds on the attainment of the wisdom of the Buddhas. Now, there's much more to this chapter, and especially around illness, and I recommend you listen to Kate's talk on the weekend, because Kate really expanded this beautifully. All right. So now we're on to the next chapter, and this is what I'm going to try to focus on tonight. In the next chapter, we find Vimalakirti on his sickbed still, wondering why the Buddha has not come to pay a visit, or at least sent someone to check on him, right? And the Buddha, of course, knows what must be going on with Vimalakirti, because the Buddha, at least in this sutra, has pretty psychic powers. He knows what the Vimalakirti is thinking. So the Buddha begins by asking his main disciples, one by one, to go and pay a visit on Vimalakirti, a sick visit. And one by one, each of them declines the honor. Or perhaps declining the honor is putting it too politely. They say, I'm too embarrassed to go. So the Buddha begins by first asking Shariputra, who is famous for his insight, one of these early disciples of the Buddha. He says, oh, Shariputra, you go. But Shariputra says, oh, no, no, I can't possibly go. Saying that one time he was meditating under a tree in a great forest. And Vimalakirti approached him and said, ah, Shariputra, you should not assume that this sort of sitting is true quiet sitting, true quiet meditation. True quiet meditation is to have a quiet mind while engaged in the activities of daily life. Vimalakirti tells Shariputra that meditation isn't primarily a means of turning away from the world, but rather of engaging it. Engaging it directly. A way to see the world more clearly and to become more skillful in responding to it. So, rather than retreating to a forest, nice and quiet, sitting under a tree, and leading a quiet meditative life, he says, a truly quiet meditative life is to be thoroughly exposed to the world rather than sealed off to it. So in other words, a quiet mind while dealing with the kids, a quiet mind while washing the dishes, while doing your tax forms. Right? A quiet mind, even then. So Shariputra, feeling rather rebuked in this matter, feels unworthy to go to visit the Buddha. And again, Kate kind of fleshes this out more in her talk on Sunday, so do give it a listen. But it's interesting, the Buddha didn't try to strong-arm Shariputra into going. Instead, he asked the person sitting right beside him, the next disciple, Malgayayana, famed for his supernatural powers, one of these guys who got, you know, telepathy, etc., I guess. So he said, oh, would you please go on my behalf? But Malgayayana replied to the Buddha that he also dared not to accept the instruction to go and inquire about Shariputra's illness. And he said, I quote, I recall how once in the past I entered the great city of Vaishali, and in its streets and lanes expounded the Dharma for the sake of lay believers. And at that time, Vimalakirti approached and said to me, ah, Malgayayana, when you expound the Dharma for the white-robed lay believers, you should not expound it in the way that you're doing. Expounding the Dharma should be done in accordance with the Dharma, in other words, with reality itself. And Vimalakirti then explained that the Dharma, the true Dharma, is not just the rules and philosophy of the Buddhist view, it is the actual reality of everything. The true Dharma is the fundamental unity of everything. So this is his part of his reply. I won't go into the whole thing. Shariputra says, the Dharma accords with emptiness. In other words, the boundlessness of everything. Follows what is formless, responds to what is actionless. The Dharma is separate from beauty or ugly. In other words, there's no division in the Dharma. The Dharma knows no increase or decrease. The Dharma knows no birth nor any extinction. The Dharma knows no destination. It just always is. The Dharma transcends eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Does that sound familiar? The Heart Sutra that we chant almost every service, right? The Dharma knows no high and low. The Dharma constantly abides without moving. Ah, Magalayana. Since the characteristics of the Dharma are such as these, how can you expound it? Interesting question, eh? If the Dharma includes everything, how do you expound it? How do you talk about it? So Vimalakirti, I think, says, given the true nature of Dharma, how could one possibly teach it? I think this is a very important instruction for us. We want to know stuff, right? We want the teachers to tell us, oh, this is how it is, right? This is how it is. It's not black, it's white. It's not ABC, it's DEF. Right? Please tell me the truth. Please save me. End my anguish, my confusion. In our Zen tradition, there is a koan, or a story, that I think reflects this very beautifully. So let me tell you this story. One day, when the great Chinese ancestor, one of our great teachers, Huangbo, had taken his place on the teacher's seat, this is in ancient China, in the assembly hall, he began to lecture to the monks and nuns who were gathered there. He said, "You people are just like drunkards. I don't know how you manage to stand on your own two feet. Everyone will die laughing at you. Can't you understand that in the whole of this great Chinese empire, there are no teachers of Zen?" Imagine if Kate and I said that. There are no teachers of Zen.
You're all drunkards.
You're all drunkards. Can't stand your own two feet. And then at this point, as I'm sure one of you are thinking right now, one of the monks presently asked, "How can you say that at this very moment, as all can see, we are sitting here face to face with you, an honored teacher of monks and leaders of people?" Maybe you wouldn't quite phrase it that way, but Huangbo then replies, "I did not say there is no Zen. I merely pointed out there are no teachers. There are no teachers of Zen." Now, when we come to practice, I think what, no matter what practice we come to, ultimately we have to mature to the point where we realize, there is no teacher. Not in the way that I originally thought the teacher would be. Because you cannot teach this. This is something we each search for in our hearts. And the teacher is not really teaching, but simply pointing along the way. And sometimes that's helpful, and sometimes it's not. But each of us discovers, I think, this beautiful unity of everything. Or maybe discover is not quite the right word. Maybe it's we awaken to. So anyway, I digress here a little bit. So in the end, Malgayayana says, when Vimalakirti expounded the Dharma in this way, 800 lay believers set their minds on attaining perfect wisdom. And I possess no such eloquence as this. Therefore, I say, I am not competent to visit him and inquire about his illness. Okay. So, the Buddha then turns to Mahakashyapa, disciple number 3, known for his great ascetic practices. Buddha says, you must go visit Vimalakirti and inquire about his illness. But guess what? Mahakashyapa replies to the Buddha, oh, world-honored one, I am not competent to visit him and inquire about his illness. Why? Because I recall how in the past I was begging for alms in a poor village. At that time, Vimalakirti approached and said to me, ah, Mahakashyapa, you have a mind marked by compassion and pity, but you do not know how to apply it equally. Instead, you shun the rich and mighty and beg alms among the poor. Mahakashyapa, you must abide by the principle of equanimity, and in that spirit go about begging for food, because in the end, there is no receiving. In that spirit, one receives this food. So here, Vimalakirti is challenging Mahakashyapa to question his avoidance of the rich area of town, to go begging, collecting alms, which was the custom of that time, only in the poor area. Maybe Mahakashyapa was being a little bit proud, like, oh, I'm not going to go to the rich places because I'm humble. I'm just going to go knock on the poor doors and get the little bit of rice and whatever they have left. That's good enough for me. Maybe he's making that kind of comparison. Or maybe there's another reason. But the point here is that Mahakashyapa, for whatever reason, has drawn a line between the wealthy and the poor. He's made a distinction. In our meal chant, when we have formal meals, we have a little chant. And there's that famous line, which I, you know, Kate and I have repeated many times in our Dharma talks. And the line goes, may we with all living beings realize the emptiness of the three wills, giver, receiver, and gift. That there is no clear distinction between the giver and the receiver. And the gift itself. So this is the core, I think, of Vimalakirti's teaching to Mahakashyapa. Rather than focusing on the homes of the poor for whatever reason, to see all beings with the same eye of equanimity and equality. And so, I won't go through them all, because it goes through 8 more disciples. All of them, like, oh, I couldn't possibly go. And I think it's the 9th. Buddha finally turns to his own son, Rahula, who is also a disciple. And the Buddha said to Rahula, well, you must go visit Vimalakirti and ask about his illness. But Rahula said to the Buddha, world-honored one, I am not competent to visit him and ask about his illness. Why? Because I recall how once in the past, the sons of the wealthy men of Vaishali, this is the city, came to a place where I was, bowed their heads, and questioned me. Ah, Rahula, they said, you are the Buddha's son, but you cast aside your claim to the rank of king, because the Buddha was in line to be king And Rahula's son did the same thing to become a monk and left the householder life to become a monk. What benefits does one acquire by leaving the household life and becoming a monk? Good questions for us these days, eh? Got several people interested. So in other words, these sons of Vaishali's wealthy men wondered, what are the benefits from leaving home and entering the monastic life? Now, according to the understanding and tradition of the early Buddhist, early Buddhism, entering the monastic order and remaining long ordained is really great merit. So Rahula said, well, he's saying now, speaking to the Buddha, I explained to these sons the benefits and blessing one gains by leaving the household life, as the law, the Buddhist practice at that time describes them. But at that time, Vimalakirti approached and said to me, Ah, Rahula, you should not speak of the benefits and blessings gained by leaving the householder's life. And then, Vimalakirti asserts the virtues of leaving home from the perspective of the ultimate truth. What he says is, well, it is true, there are some benefits to leaving the householder life, but only in the conditioned world that you can speak of benefits and virtues. But he says true renunciation, truly leaving the householder life, is unconditioned. It is letting go of your ideas of what it is all about. And truly, in true renunciation, there's no merit or benefit, because true renunciation is deeply acknowledging the unity and oneness of all things, which in Buddhism sometimes is called the unconditioned. In other words, relatively speaking, leaving home is a virtuous act. But ultimately speaking, nothing exists independently, and so there is no merit to gain or to lose. Everything shares this fundamental unity. So how could there be merit? Is that making sense? It's a little bit out there. But again, we have another Zen story that illustrates this well, or at least illustrates it. And this is the meeting that happened between Bodhidharma, the Indian ancestor who first brought the Zen tradition from India into China. This Bodhidharma's meeting with the Emperor of China, who at that time was known as Emperor Wu of the Liang Dynasty. And this Emperor of China had been a fervent patron of Buddhism, because Buddhism was relatively new in China at that time. And he asked Bodhidharma, how much merit have I earned for paying for the ordination of monks and nuns, building monasteries, having all these sutras copied, and commissioning Buddhist images? And the emperor's expecting, whoa, I bet tons of merit. And Bodhidharma replied, none. So this reply of Bodhidharma, there's no merit, was from the aspect of the ultimate truth, that nothing has intrinsic or separate existence. Everything, like water in a river, not separate. So Vimalakirti goes on to say that leaving the household life does not ultimately mean becoming a monk or a nun. Rather, it means abandoning our confused views, such as externalism, everything is outside of me, or nihilism, that nothing really exists, renouncing what is harmful to oneself or harmful to others. It means taking the path of practice as the very heart of one's life, That's what leaving home means. And this part of the sutra ends by these young men saying, well, according to the Buddhist law, we who are still not yet full adults cannot become monks or nuns unless the parents allow it. And our parents will not allow us to formally ordain. And Vimalakirti says, okay, in that case, just set your minds, set your hearts on attaining awakening. And that is the same as leaving the household life. That is the same as taking monastic vows. So altogether, I think there's 10 of these little vignettes that happen in this chapter regarding the disciples. And in almost all the stories, Vimalakirti is warning against making the teachings or the practice into an object or a thing. And isn't this what we tend to do? Right? Oh, it says this. I believe this, or I think this is true. This is it. And Vimalakirti in all these stories is kind of saying, no, no. We cannot make the teachings or our practices into some kind of object or thing that we hold on to. Or we get stuck again, as these disciples were a little bit stuck. And this kind of caution is actually present, I think, in many of the religious traditions. I remember reading in the Tao Te Ching, the famous text in Taoism, that the first opening line highlights this problem that we have. And this is a problem we all have in our practices. The line goes like this. The Tao or the way that can be described is not the eternal way. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. When we come to practice, whatever the practice is, we want to do it right. Am I sitting right? Are my legs crossed right? What should I do with my mind? How do I hold my hands? And all of that, to a certain extent, is important and necessary to know. But at some point, we have to wake up and realize that's really not what it's about. It's not the way, as they say in Chinese, the Tao. We have to go beyond. And I think our sitting practice is a wonderful way of going beyond. We sit, still, unmoving, letting the heart and mind settle. And what happens next, as one teacher said, is none of your business. You cannot control it. Just do the practice. The rest is none of your business. I know it's hard. But that's the way it is. So I think I'll stop talking here so we still have some time to talk together. And what we'll do is we'll get together in triads, kind of groups of three. And I'll ask you, each person will get about 3 minutes to kind of reflect on what I just said. And I'll give you a question or two to kind of spark some conversation. The other two people in the triad will just listen carefully, give your full attention. There's no crosstalk. If the person who's speaking has finished saying all they need to say in a minute and a half or 2 minutes, you can just, all three of you, sit there in silence until I ring the bell for the next person to go. And after everyone's finished, whatever is said in the triad just stays there. We don't bring it up again outside in any way. Okay, and just no need to respond to what anyone else has said. So let's see, 1, 2.
And
three.
For those of you who won't be staying, that would be a good time to
leave. 11, 12. Yeah. So thank you. Let's see. Let me just count people again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Oh, perfect. So, goodbye. Thank you. Count off to groups of four. So just count off to four. 1, 2, 3, 4.
1, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay, remember number fours here. Threes, twos, ones. Okay, and so just move your seat, just kind of quickly gather to your number. And then in a moment, I'll ring the bell.